We'll engineer another rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the electrified studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with another rain report. How many electrical engineers do you know? Just what is an electrical engineer? What do they do? And how is an electrical engineer's career influenced by a digital or RF background? For these answers and more, Rains Hap Holly, KC9RP, turned to a guy who knows. He's Don Dangle, W9TOC, a resident of Palatine, Illinois. Don spent a few minutes in the rain booth at the 2016 Dayton Hamvention.
An electrical engineer takes the theory of electricity and electronics and makes it do useful things for people. There was always recognized to be two main branches of electrical engineering. One is electric power, and that would be engineers who not only design the electrical equipment that distributes electricity, generators, transformers, and the like, but also manages the distribution. So they would work in load dispatch centers and things like that. So that's electric power engineering. And there's also a discipline now that's very up and coming with the emphasis on energy conservation and all the new lower cost semiconductors that can switch large amounts of current. And so these electrical power engineers are designing circuits to save energy and driving electric motors. So that's power engineering, and then there's electronics, which is what I'm in, and then there are so many different sub-disciplines in electrical engineering in the electronics field. There's people who design electronics for various types of products. They'll do hardware and software. Also, some who operate large networks or design systems, so you can do it from the system level or all the way down to the component level.
Where do you fall into this?
Mostly I work at the component level. Over the course of my career, I've been on design teams that we all have a little sub-assembly to work on and make sure it plays well. So I started my career working in the first generation mobile cellular telephone, and after that I moved on to many years in automotive electronics, and we designed the electronics that actually goes into your car at the time of manufacture, and you'd be surprised how many microcontrollers are in a modern automobile these days.
What is different about the components that you're working with now versus those that were available 20 years ago?
Electronics components used to be leaded parts where a resistor would have wire leads on it, capacitors, transistors, and the like. And in order to get more components in smaller space, they've gone to leadless. So a capacitor looks like a little chip of something, and you can get chip transistors, chip resistors, and then integrated circuits have also changed. The leads have gotten smaller to the point where you can get packages where instead of leads all in a row, in two rows, which that was a dual inline package, they've gone to packages where they have wire leads coming out all four sides of a square chip, and that would be like a microcontroller. And you solder that down. And then there's also a package called ball grid array where connections to the outside world are actually underneath the chip. And once the chip gets soldered onto the circuit board, you can't even see the connections. You can only inspect them with x-rays. The chip parts that I mentioned, the ball grid arrays, those are all surface mount technology because there aren't any wire leads to put through holes on the circuit board. In fact, you don't have to drill holes for wire leads anymore with surface mount circuit boards. You still drill tiny holes for vias, and those are copper connections that go between different layers of the circuit board. I've worked with single layer circuit board, dual layer, that's where you have a layer on top and bottom. But your modern smartphone today might have a 10-layer circuit board, a top, a bottom, and 8 layers inside to carry all the circuits. So you drill holes to make the connections, and you plate the copper to make connections in between those internal layers. There is etching, and then there's built-up plating. You start with the inner layer, that you start out with the inner substrate, and then you build up the inner layers, one on top of another, and then you build up the top layer. And there's build-up and etching processes involved in all of those steps.
With all of this layering, I would imagine that heat is even more of an issue than it was when you only had the single layer.
Yes, you have to be very careful to manage the heat. With the automotive electronics, we're switching a lot of DC currents, and so the traces still have to be thick and wide, and there's no substitute for that. There's actually tables that were developed. If you want to carry a certain amount of current for a certain duty cycle, given a particular ambient temperature, this is how wide the trace has to be and how thick it has to be. So there's tables and rules of thumb that are very well understood that we use for guidelines. And in fact, there's an organization called Institute for Packaging and Connection, IPC, that maintains all the recommended standards for printed circuit board layout. That way, if you're in doubt about something, you can find out what the best practice is and you're not having to learn it the hard way.
Or reinvent the wheel, as they say.
Exactly.
In what you do, how has that changed over the last 20 years?
I did miss out on the vacuum tube era. I'm not that old. When I started, all electronic components were still leaded, but shortly into my career, I'd say about 5 or 6 years into my career, the very first surface mount parts started to appear. The microprocessor was a fairly new development. I was doing microprocessor software programming as an undergraduate, and when I started working, I could see how that market just literally exploded. All kinds of good designs and things you could do with microprocessors that you couldn't do any other way economically. And so it revolutionized electronics products and design and such. And then also computer-aided design. We didn't have that in school, although we did have computer circuit simulation, SPICE. Being able to lay out a circuit board on a CAD computer-aided design was very time-saving. I was fortunate that when I started in my career, that the very first CAD tools were coming on the market and commercially successful. One of the big ones was made by General Electric, and that was called Calma. And then a company called Mentor Graphics came on very strong in that market and had very good CAD tools for a very long time. And now there's other players in that space as well.
Where does Wi-Fi fall into all this?
Wi-Fi became practical with the advent of low-cost integrated circuits that could operate at radio frequencies. In the early days of personal computers, they might have had a 4 megahertz clock speed. I can remember the very first personal computer that I bought in 1990, I believe, had a 16 megahertz clock, and we thought that was blazing fast, and now it's gone to the gigahertz range routinely. Getting integrated circuits to work fast made Wi-Fi possible because you could package an entire radio and processing inside one chip the size of your thumbnail at a very reasonable cost. And that's what really made it possible.
The miniaturization of all these various circuits and complete devices is wonderful, but that means you're having to replace the whole unit rather than trying to fix it.
That's correct. A lot of the new electronics just simply is not very repairable. It's been designed for manufacturability, at least in the consumer world. A lot of industrial electronics is designed for repairability. It costs more, yes, but when the cost of having your plant down is so much more, you'll pay a little bit extra for the industrial electronics that's easier to repair. When I worked at Motorola, we had base station hardware was called Quantar. It was designed so that multiple radio modules would fit in a rack, and if one module went down, the rest of the system would still work. It would send an alarm so that the technician could go out to the site and replace that module, but the rest of the system stayed running. You didn't have to take the whole system down to swap out a module, for example. And so the repairability and the serviceability was very important because uptime, when you have a public safety radio system, you can't afford it to be down ever. Same thing with telephone equipment.
You're listening to a conversation between RAIN's founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, and electrical engineer Don Dangle, W9TOC, that took place in the RAIN booth at the 2016 Dayton Hamvention. We'll conclude their discussion in a moment. The RAIN Report is available 24/7 on therainreport.com via Twitter at The RAIN Report when it works, and via iTunes.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
One of the criticisms that has been leveled against Motorola in recent years is that so many of its engineers now are digital smart, but they're not RF smart.
I worked with a lot of very smart digital guys and very smart RF guys. Digital, I think, was a lot easier to experiment with in college. I think a lot of students are more familiar with it. I don't know a lot of kids that actually played with RF down at the circuit level in college. I think there had to be a lot of learning on the job. That's my impression anyway. The digital hardware is so much easier to acquire, to play with, to get it working. Not a lot of kids are into amateur radio, so they don't have a chance to put stuff on the air, although that may be changing with the Wi-Fi. But if they're working at the module level and not at the circuit level, then that could be a concern too, because you still need to work at the component level. Somebody still has to work at the component level.
But you still have to have the RF knowledge, because you can have the greatest circuitry and components in the world, but if you don't know how to get a signal from that system to where it needs to go, then it may just sit there and do nothing.
Right. Well, working at an RF company, even though I was not an RF engineer per se, I knew how to make all the test equipment work. I could use a network analyzer. I knew how to read a Smith chart. From my ham radio background, if I needed to test a subsection at the baseband level, I could set up the arbitrary function generator to give me the modulation I need, pipe it into the correct RF port, use the correct connectors, make sure you maintain 50 ohms and all of that. I think you pick up a lot of it by osmosis when you work in an area like that. You learn from the RF engineers. Now that I work at a company where we do electronic registration for a mechanical meter, I'm picking up a lot of mechanical engineering. I'm picking up a lot of fluid mechanics, and I'm not a mechanical engineer by training, but I still have to know how the meter works so that we do the registration correctly. So I think it comes down to, once you get at the working level, to keep your mind open. So if you work at an RF company, yes, pay attention to what the RF guys are doing, and you may find it fun. And if you're early in your career and you express an interest, your managers would certainly be happy to have you work on project teams and pick up the technique and all of that. Because with RF especially, there's only so much you can teach out of a textbook, and a lot of it you have to learn by doing. You learn how to lay out a PC strip line so that it's 50 ohms. And then once you get the impedances all matched from the RF to the antenna port, you still have to worry about spurious things, and so you have to know how to put bypasses for your particular frequencies around your circuit board. So it all depends on the nature of your product.
What impact has amateur radio had on your career?
I have been told more than once by a manager that having the ham radio experience on my resume or mentioning it in an interview gave me an edge in their decision to bring me on their team. I also get to use it on the job a little bit. For many years, I was, and still am, fascinated with electromagnetic compatibility, so I know how to run an EMC susceptibility test. I know how to read a spectrum when I see a radiated emissions analysis. I know where all the major radio services are, so I know what might be affected or what might affect the circuit depending on its environment, things like that. It has helped me and continues to help me in many ways.
In ham radio, of course, we have to be careful about spurious emissions and second order harmonics and intermod and so forth. How much of does any of that play into what you're doing today?
Well, the equipment is so good today that unless something is really wrong, you're not going to see spurs or IM, something like that, unless something is defective or broken. I've never encountered it in any of my experience or my equipment. I know that when you're designing something, you want to be sure that the equipment meets the spectral purity requirements and isn't susceptible to IM. But I haven't had to do any work at that where the manager says, okay, we've got an IM problem, let's take a look at it. That hasn't been part of my experience. I guess I would like to say to any young people that are listening that if you're involved in amateur radio as a youngster, it will open doors for you. It will keep you focused if you get involved in middle school or high school. It will make your studies more relevant to you. You'll understand why they're teaching you something, and then that can make it more enjoyable to learn. Ham radio taught me geography. It taught me how to point my antenna to a particular part of the world. I got to know all the call sign prefixes of different countries. If a country changed administration, I knew there might be a prefix change, such as when the Berlin Wall came down and East Germany became Germany, for example. But it helped me focus on my math and science studies. It gave me goals to shoot for in high school. When I got to college, I had instant friends, and I'm still in touch with most of them today. So you will have friends for a lifetime. It will help your college experience be enjoyable. I actually took a couple of classes that we jokingly called advanced ham radio, just so I could appreciate the hobby more. All these classes helped me in my career. Amateur radio opened doors for me in the working world. Employers, if they see that you have an amateur radio license, that gives you an edge because you know which end of a soldering iron is really hot. So by all means, put amateur radio on your resume. Put your call letter, put your license class on there. If they ask you about hobbies, do tell them about that, because that will give you an edge in the interview. It still helps me in my career to this day.
And that concludes a conversation about the nuts and bolts of electrical engineering between Don Dengel, W9TOC, a resident of Palatine, Illinois, and Rains Hap Holly, KC9RP, that took place in the Rain booth at the 2016 Dayton Hamvention. The Rain Report is copyright 1990, 2016 Rain. All rights are reserved. Now, for all you digital and RF types connected with the Rain Report, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, available on demand from therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes. Keep on hamming!